Dr. Alan Thompson, Department of Surgery, and Dr. Roberto Estrada, Department of Surgery. Thank you. It is a most exciting time. After a few false starts, as all of you know, the future has in fact arrived. I think that's our job, inventing the future, and as it relates to the Glenn site and the long-awaited super hospital, it's here. You know, on April 1st, there was a groundbreaking ceremony which celebrated the agreement by the MUHC and the provincial government to go ahead with the construction of this project. The timeline, the elements that had to take place afterward are happening apace, and sometime before July 15th, there will be the financial close which will allow the site construction to begin. And the excitement surrounding this on the part of the clinical colleagues and the research colleagues in the MUHCRI is really quite extraordinary. The MAHN, for those of you who don't remember, it stands for the McGill Academic Health Network. It's what we've been trying to give birth to for a number of years, and it describes this structure. And we've made a good deal of progress this year at a meeting of the directors general and their chairs of the boards of the four primary teaching hospitals. There was an agreement that we would have at the end of August, beginning of September, a retreat of that group with which forms the principal's council on health affairs, and try and describe the first activities of the Academic Health Network. This is an attempt to use the power of the university as a unifying concept to move the activities in our primary teaching hospitals toward a little more integration. And I think this will be an exciting development for us as well. Not to steal Mara's thunder, but part of the strategic planning process has already yielded results, and the Senate last week gave approval to a modification of titles and how we deal with our faculty, so that the old problem that so many of you raised, that if you are in the GFTH category, you are automatically a part-timer at McGill, is over. And non-tenure-track faculty who are full-time are now recognized as full-time. And she will have more to say about this in the description of what the Professorial Lifecycle Committee has done in the strategic planning process. So much about a new future of hospitals, of our faculty, of strategic planning. Our future also requires that we remain accredited. And as I have told you, last time around, when the LCME reviewed our progress report, they threatened us with probation, because we have so many, 13 accreditation standards, which they believe we are not in full compliance, and we have not been in full compliance for over a two-year cycle, which gets you in trouble. The elements, these 13 elements, cover the whole spectrum of what we do here. Some minor things and some major things. We didn't describe adequately our strategic planning process. Well, when we got into this, we actually didn't have one. But as you all know, we do now in spades. The oversight of clinical conditions encountered by students, a link to that, comparable educational experiences across all alternative instructional sites. The fact that there must be 100% feedback midway through each clerkship on how the students are doing. That there must be a periodic review of the curriculum spelled out rather formally. That there must be monitoring of the educational objectives, making certain that everyone who has contact with students at any time, in any circumstance, understands the overriding objectives of the medical school and the specific objectives of that course or clerkship. Student hours during clerkships are often abused and abused flippantly. If you go home now, you're not a real doctor. Well, those sorts of statements put us in harm's way. This is not a time when we can play with such a standard lightly. An interest in increasing student diversity. Conflicts of interest among staff that provide counseling services to students, that's been taken care of fully. Student mistreatment at McGill, I'll come back to that in a moment. The fact that feedback to faculty, especially those referred to as GFTH faculty in the old days, was inadequate. Data on financial resources to make certain that the medical school can keep going, and the quality of the instructional and life facilities at the hospitals for our students are considered inadequate. Of these, one that has been consistent and very disturbing, as we have discussed here previously, is the statement that is recognized by the students in their so-called graduation or exit questionnaire. I was personally mistreated during medical school, and the vast majority of this is on the during the clinical experience. This shows you what the response rate positively to this question has been from 05 to 09. And yes, it bounces around quite a bit. This is the Canadian average, ending at 26.1%, rising across these years. And McGill went from 22, which is high and always higher than the Canadian average, to its highest, which was 53.6 by the class of 2009. Now, we have a lot of explanations for this. We're talking about it. We're doing simulations about it. The environment is open to reporting. And so we might anticipate that before the problem gets better, it might be reported as getting worse. And maybe that is an artifact of the reporting likelihood. But we're higher than everyone else. And the chairs in the Faculty Leadership Council have discussed the fact that we now must move to a zero-tolerance program. And it's very complicated because the origins of the mistreatment, the perception of mistreatment, are faculty, residents, nurses, staff, and fellow students. So it's very big, and it's difficult to cure all of that. But we are monitoring the complaints of harassment monthly, and we do that with the 145 assessment program, and the chairs have agreed to try and cut down the number of these complaints, which reflect the number of incidents in the clinical milieu, to zero. And it is a major challenge for us. One of the responses to this problem has been the decision to pass a code of conduct, which many of you have seen in a variety of contexts. It was discussed at many departmental meetings. It has now been approved by the faculty and is in force as our mutual collective code of conduct that describes our set of interactions with each other as professionals, and will be important in trying to bring this problem under control. And we could talk about each of these topics for most of the afternoon. I would beg your indulgence so that we will not discuss these individual elements now. If you have questions or comments about these, we'll wrap them up toward the end of the meeting. But I would like to get to the main topic of the afternoon, which is a discussion of where our three major design groups have landed at the moment as an important late point in the process for extensive consultation with you. You know that we have had individual town hall meetings in each of the areas of the design groups. We are not alone in facing strategic planning at a time 100 years after the Flexner Report changed the way Western medicine was taught and delivered. And we have today reports from our three major undergraduate-focused, centrally-focused design groups, education, research, and the faculty life cycle. We will not today discuss the other three components to this process, which are the administrative excellence and the reports from the three professional schools who join us in this faculty. And we will do that subsequently. But I'd like now to invite the chairs of the design groups to come up front, and we will move to a discussion of the first, which is the Educational Design Group report, and Joyce Pickering is going to deliver their findings.
So I'm going to talk to you about the Education Design Group, what we're proposing, and there'll be some time for questions at the end. I first want to acknowledge my partners in crime, Dr. David Eidelman, the chair of the Department of Medicine, and Dr. John Orlowski, chair of the Department of Physiology, who were the co-chairs with me, and to thank Melissa Nock, who provided administrative support. I think, as they say, it's important not just what you know, but who you know. And so one of the things that was very important to our committee was to make sure we had broad representation on the committee. I will show you at the end the names of all the people, but we explicitly sought out both basic scientists and clinical scientists, allied schools, students, residents, hospital representation in the form of a director of professional services, the Ministry of Health, and administrative staff. Just want to remind you that education is a very large mandate in our faculty. I list them all there, and I won't read through them all for you. And almost everybody in our faculty is closely involved with education in one way or another with some of these many, many students that we have. We are focusing in this particular group on the 700 medical students, and it's not to say that the other ones aren't as important, just to say that we did this first, and there will be other plans for other schools in the future. I want to explain our processes as we reviewed education. The first thing was we wanted as much as possible to base our discussions and our recommendations on evidence. We wanted to do things not just because they were the style or they were popular, but as much as possible to say that there seems to be evidence from studies that these things are good. The second thing was it was important to us to consult as widely as we could, both internationally and locally and from people from many different backgrounds. We divided our task group into three groups. We talked about the teaching of basic sciences. What are the basic sciences that medical students need to know? There is so much out there to learn. How do we focus on what's the most important and teach that effectively? The second area was best practices in teaching. how do we make sure that we're as effective as possible. And finally, we talked about the teaching of family medicine, public health, and the teaching of the delivery of healthcare and healthcare systems. And you'll see why we focused on those in a minute. As part of our processes, we had 3 faculty-wide seminars. You were all invited. I hope that some of you were able to attend a couple of them. Our dean, Dr. Levin, spoke early on, I think in October. Dr. Molly Cook and Dr. Jordan Cohen came, and we had all of them actually comment on the work that we had done and took their comments into consideration for our final report. These are the steps that we went through and the way I'll present it to you. So the first is, what was our vision? What should a McGill MDCM graduate look like? Because that should inform all of our subsequent decisions. What are the areas we need to work on? What are the strengths, the things that we should maintain? And what were the concrete proposals that we came up with? So these are the attributes that, after some brainstorming, we came up with. I'm going to go through them because I think they're all important. Stage-appropriate clinical expertise, the attributes of physicianship, which I hope many of you know by now combine healer and professionalism, attributes, effective communication skills, interprofessional skills, an ability to be part of a team, critical thinking and decision-making, evidence of the skills necessary to adapt to changes in practice, technology, and societal needs, understanding of the healthcare system and the role of public health, and the understanding of scholarship through independent work. And I know that when I list them like this, it looks a little bit like a lot of motherhood statements. How could anybody disagree with any of these things? But we thought it was important to make them explicit so that we can then link changes that we make and our criteria for whether we judge someone as deserving of the MD degree specifically to these attributes. Where do we fail currently? So Dr. Levin has already addressed some of the accreditation issues. Just to remind you that one of the accreditation requirements is continual revision of the curriculum. And I used to think that, you know, one of these days we could get it right, we would have the perfect curriculum, and then we could just stay with it, and it would be much easier that way. But in fact, in this era of changing knowledge, both about science and pedagogy, that's not an option. We have to continually revise our curriculum. That's actually a requirement of accreditation. Central management of the curriculum is another requirement. So what does that mean? It means that we can't go to the Department of Medicine and say, okay, medicine, you know what's important for teaching students, what's important medicine, you just do it, and the same with the other departments. That centrally, in other words, my office has to say, this is what we want you to teach. Please do this. Surgery, this is what you want to teach. Thirdly, mistreatment of trainees, and I won't go into that any further right now because Dr. Levin has already addressed it. Another area in which we have difficulties is in meeting societal needs. We have a limited number of students who choose family medicine. We have about the lowest percentage of our students choose family medicine of all the 17 Canadian schools. Those of you who work in the clinical setting know it's much more difficult to get a family doctor for your patient than it is to get almost any specialist you can name. And at some of the other meetings that I was at, I presented the data that shows that health of populations is correlated positively to the number of family doctors per population and unfortunately negatively correlated to the number of specialists per population. We have a relatively, among our students, a relatively poor understanding of public health and the healthcare system, and I say this because we have data from standardized exams that show our students are near the bottom in terms of their scores on these particular elements. They do well in many other aspects. Where else do we fail? Evolution of medical practice. Now, I don't have data to show specifically that we fail, but I think this is an absolute key issue for all practicing physicians. Medical knowledge changes so quickly. The idea that you've learned what you need to know by the time you finish residency is just not true anymore. If we cannot teach our students to continually learn for the rest of their lives, you know, what I tell them is you might as well be dead in the water. And for certain, scholarship and critical thinking are an important part of this. We do some teaching about this, but we felt strongly that we need to have a much more explicit focus on those aspects. Interprofessionalism, how you work in a team, how you work with nursing, physiotherapies, other healthcare deliverers, other healthcare professionals. Some of you may know about current work in patient safety and medical error, and one of the things that's been identified as the most fundamental problems is physicians' inability to work well in teams in terms of preventing patient error. And we do a little bit of that, but a very limited amount, and we felt strongly we needed to improve that aspect. In pedagogy, we felt we had insufficient use of small groups and simulation training. The small groups are too large. They have multiple tutors. Now, all this is for reasons that I'm sure you're as familiar as I am. It's very labor and resource intensive to teach in simulation, to teach in small groups. But it doesn't negate the fact that there are probably much more effective ways of teaching them than by lecture. The central control of the curriculum, I've spoken a little bit about that already. Clerkships in particular tend to be apprenticeship based. In other words, you know, you show up to your obstetrics clerkship, you see what comes in the door, you take care of it. You know, you may or may not see certain things, but the idea is by the time you finish your 4 years, you've probably been exposed enough. And that's unfortunately a model that's no longer acceptable. I've written too many teachers, which might surprise you, but the problem, of course, we have, in particularly in the basis of medicine, is many teachers coming in for 1 or 2 hours, sometimes a little bit more than that. But this is a real challenge with respect to cohesion for students, because sometimes the courses start to resemble seminar series rather than real courses. It's not all bad news. We've got some real strengths as well. So we do system-based teaching in the basis of medicine, where students learn about a particular system, the physiology, the biochemistry, the anatomy, histology related to that. That's a model that many schools are moving towards, and yet it's a model we've had in place for about 15 years now. So we felt that was a strength, and that we should keep the systems-based teaching. Those of you who work clinically know that we have a portion of the curriculum called Introduction to Clinical Medicine. It's the second half of second year, and it bridges the basis of medicine and clerkship. Students are in the hospitals having a lot of clinical exposure with no responsibility. It's fairly unique across medical schools, and it's highly rated by the students and felt to be one of the reasons, in fact, that students are given a lot of responsibility and have a good experiences doing clerkship. I hope many of you are already familiar with the physicianship program, which was introduced now about 5 years ago. So these are courses that run throughout the 4 years, but of particular relevance, all our students now, when they start, are assigned in groups of 5 or 6 to one faculty member who meets with them throughout the whole 4 years. So that opportunity to develop that kind of relationship and have that kind of mentoring is really fairly unique and something good that we thought we should keep. So what do we propose? So of course we propose that we keep our strengths. We want to maintain our systems-based teaching. We want to maintain an ICM-type phase of the curriculum, and we wanted to maintain the physicianship program. What do we propose to change? We don't do enough training for primary care. We don't do enough training for lifelong learning, and we need more training for teamwork and leadership. So, specifically, with respect to training for primary care, our task force recommended the institution of a longitudinal clinical experience beginning in first year, with an emphasis on family medicine, and integrating clinical experiences with the basic sciences that are being learned during the units. This sounds easy to say. Practically, it's a huge deal to find family physicians or other primary care physicians for 175 students, and once you bring the second year students in, 350 students or so. And it also has major implications for scheduling and what we could do with classes. And we would have to cut down the number of lecture hours significantly in order to accommodate that. Some of you may have heard that we are beginning an integrated clerkship in the Gatineau starting this August. 9 students will be going there. We're very excited about this new scheduling form of clerkship. There's data from other schools that have integrated clerkships suggesting that students who go through integrated clerkships are more likely to choose primary care specialties, whether it's internal medicine, pediatrics, family medicine, or general surgery. We hope that if this is successful, we might be able to institute some of that in our hospitals in Montreal as well. Training for lifelong learning, we said that was another area that we needed to improve. We need more simulation in case-based learning in the first 2 years. We do a course in evidence-based medicine in second year, but we don't then make students do evidence-based projects in their clinical rotations, which they should do. Because we felt that scholarship should be one of the characteristics of our students, right now we don't have a requirement that students do an independent study or research project. We felt that should be a requirement. I'll just tell you that right now about 65% of our students do one, so it would be another 35%. And we felt that rather than having so many different faculty members working with the small groups, we needed to develop learning collaboratives, which would be groups of 15 or so students with one faculty member who would work through clinical presentations with them. Teamwork and leadership was the third area, and we need to add in interprofessional learning in all years of the curriculum and explicit teaching of leadership skills. We have started the leadership skills teaching with a pilot group this past year. Again, practically speaking, sounds easy. Fitting in interprofessional teaching with all the other schools and their schedules is quite challenging. The need for this, we need lots of good teachers. We need to raise the profile of teaching and make it an attractive career path to focus largely on teaching. We probably need fewer teachers in some cases, but each one teaching more. We need lots of faculty development. And I just like, for some of you have probably been involved as Osler Fellows, that was a huge faculty development project that's been very successful in training these people. Centralization of our curriculum management, and always, always we need to measure these things and know whether we're really achieving what we say we're setting out to do and whether students are truly meeting those characteristics. Medical students are only one small part of the equation, of course. All this needs to be extended to postgrad and faculty members as well. These were all the members of the design group. I won't go through them, but just to show you that there were many, many people who contributed many evenings and weekends to making this design group a success. And I'd like to leave it open for questions. I'd like to leave it for questions now for the education director.
To have 10 minutes or so of most of you that are related to each of the presentations, and then we'll also continue the discussion after that. So, we're first.
Okay, yeah, so you're completely right. That's a really good question.
Yeah.
How do we propose to do this was the question. So we would like to start for the class that starts in 2012. We figure that we'll need probably at least a year and a half. And the biggest part of our challenge will be the first 18 months of the curriculum, where we have to take our overall objectives for not only for the big sort of attributes that I listed, but the specific clinical conditions. So some of you may know the Medical Council of Canada has listed 132 clinical conditions that medical students need to be able to deal with, and these are what are tested on the LMCC exams. So we need to take those and say, in order to adequately address these clinical conditions, what are the basic science principles that you need to know? And bring it down to say, this is why we teach this. So right now, in the basis of medicine, if you say to a teacher, why do you teach this particular thing? They will say, because I think it's really important. Okay? But we have to do better than that. We have to be able to say, it's going to be important because you need to know this in order to take care of a patient who comes to you with this problem, because this is one of the objectives you have to learn. So the biggest issue really is the first 18 months of the curriculum. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. I'll repeat your question if you want. No, I'll repeat it. Like, could you sort of give someone advance? Okay, so her question was, so you excuse a student from certain things? Is that what you're getting at? Sure. Oh, what are you getting at? Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so change the admission requirement. Oh, okay. 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 We didn't discuss explicitly that. I'll tell you one of the reasons we didn't discuss that explicitly. To us, when we were trying to be competitive for attracting good applicants to our school, to not be too out of line with what other medical schools require. So, for example, if it's required way more than other schools. Then our applicant pool goes down. So that's one consideration. Could I do what, sir?
I think this one here is maybe
another one. Oh, okay. Testing.
We'll see if this works. Have you costed this? But I don't only mean those two sides of costing. One is the financial cost, but the other is some sort of evaluation of the change in teaching numbers. So we have this requirement of people to teach for promotion, and so how many teachers we have, what does it mean, how do people get their teaching requirements versus not. A lot of the problem with the people flowing through is people need to get credit for teaching, so they flow through. So in costing, are we going to have fewer teachers who we're going to train and pay to do the teaching? Are we going to use the same cadre of teachers but reassign them in terms of clinical versus teaching? I mean, what is the process for looking at that mechanical side of things?
So we haven't looked at that in any great detail. All I can say is that our criteria for what we do can't be based on what teachers need to get promoted. It's got to be based on what's the best way to train physicians. So that's clear. Yeah, I mean, I think we would have to deal with that. I completely agree we'd have to deal with it, but it wouldn't be a criteria for why we would choose someone to teach.
I guess I agree with that entirely, but the thing is you have a cadre of people,
yeah,
and you know who your best teachers are. So then you're going to say, these are our best teachers, we're going to incentivize them so they teach more. Is that going to be your philosophy?
Yes.
Last question, then we'll come back to this.
Is there good evidence that systems-based teaching is better than discipline-based teaching? You pointed out that Miguel was one of the first off the bat to do systems-based teaching, but you also said the students don't do so well in tests.
Sorry, where they don't do well in tests is on the public health and health systems questions. So they do actually in their clinical, in medicine, pediatrics, and so on, we're right near the top. But, you know, that's at the end of 4 years. How that reflects on the system-based teaching that happened in years one or two, it's a long time in between, so there may not be much relationship there. There's not a lot of data that shows that if you do systems-based teaching, you're a lot better than people who do, say, course-based teaching.
It's inaccurate to say that the first systems-based teaching came in 1951 at Case Western Reserve. It's been well established in about half the North American medical school system. So this wasn't a radical transformation.
Thank you. You may know that this report is still out to sort of our external advisory group for comments, but one of the things we would very much like from you and from your colleagues is comments and input, because in the end it's the curriculum for all of us, and it's important that everybody understand and support it. So please feel free to send in more comments.
We'll move now to a discussion of the professorial life cycle design group, and Mara Lucas will discuss this.
So, good afternoon, and I'll echo Joyce's comments that these are all works in progress, and we very much welcome your comments and criticisms, and would love to hear you weigh in on some of the things that we're suggesting. So I was involved with the Faculty Lifecycle Design Group, and we looked at issues that we felt were critical to optimizing recruitment, retention, promotion, and successful careers of our faculty. And right from the get-go, there were certain issues that were quite easy to identify that as being important to our faculty. And really, we were trying to cover the gamut from cradle to grave, or recruitment to retirement, if you will. We have a very diverse faculty. We have basic science faculty, we have clinical faculty, we have tenure, we have non-tenure, we have GFTU and GFTH, although that's, as you've heard earlier from Dean Levin, that's something that seems to be evolving quite quickly. And we also have full-time versus part-time. Until last Wednesday, GFTH were considered part-time by the university, but now that's rectified. We also felt it was important to look at issues related to promotion, and finally, what are some of the issues that are important vis-a-vis retaining people at the university? What makes our professor successful? So this is the Faculty Lifecycle Design Group. It was co-chaired by myself, Neil Coleman, who's a masterful clinician, as many of you know, Michelle Tremblay, who's the director of the Goodman Cancer Center. We had 18 members in addition. As Joyce mentioned, this was a lengthy process, many meetings. But quite early on, we defined that there were five major areas or foci that we wanted to concentrate on. And that was the issue of remuneration and tenure for PhD faculty, remuneration and tenure for MD faculty, promotion criteria and recognition for GFTH faculty, issues related to work-life balance, and the important aspect of successfully mentoring our faculty. It was a lengthy process. We had multiple meetings, town hall. We had a visiting professor named Scott Wright from Johns Hopkins, who in fact is an alumnus of McGill and the internal medicine program. And he's someone who's made a career of looking at how to define clinical excellence, So we were very interested to hear from him, and he gave us a very interesting presentation. We had a town hall meeting specifically to look at some of our recommendations a couple of months ago, et cetera, et cetera. Just to give some background vis-a-vis what's happening with tenure at other medical faculties across North America, and this is actually data that relates to MD faculty, but the PhD faculty data are essentially the same. And basically, if you look at the timeline from 1985 to 2004, and the percentage of full-time MD clinical faculty, if we look at the percentage that are tenured or tenure track, it drops consistently. It's on a downward trajectory. The percentage of non-tenure track is doing the inverse. So over this last 20 years or 25 years, in fact, the nature of tenure at medical faculties is changing, and that's true also, as I mentioned, of PhD faculty. So there's something going on. So what I'd like to do is tell you about the recommendations and the thinking that led to those recommendations from the different subgroups. And first I'll start with the subgroup on remuneration and tenure for MD faculty or you know, what is affectionately labeled GFTU. So just in terms of some background, about 16% of our MD faculty is tenure or tenure track. The inverse, obviously, are non-tenure track. It represents about 190 faculty, and it represents about a third of the tenured faculty, so the MD plus PhD faculty. We had some discussion about, you know, what does tenure mean and where did it come from? How did it start? And traditionally, tenure was something that was developed at universities so that people could have academic freedom. But somehow in the last number of decades, it's evolved into more of a guarantee of financial security. So there's been an evolution to what it is that tenure is all about, if you will. As many of you know, we have issues at McGill, I think is the case at many universities, but there are a limited number of tenure positions. So that often people who deserve tenure don't get tenure. And that's a difficulty, I think, that the Faculty of Medicine has been dealing with off and on for a long time. And often there are qualified MDs who are doing all the things that are expected of someone who would be a tenured faculty, who don't have tenure because of when they were hired or what the economic situation was at the time of hired. It's not a very equitable situation. And I think it leads to an understandable amount of disgruntlement. Even within the tenured or tenure track MD faculty, there's a lot of discrepancies in terms of the level of support. It's sometimes a situation where if someone has an offer from another institution, you know, that their salary can reflect that. It depends which department perhaps they're going into. So it's not, it's not an equitable situation. There's a lack of reevaluation of performance, certainly during that initial time frame when people are in their initial 6 years and then coming up for actual tenure. There's fairly well-defined benchmarks applied, but once people have their tenure, while they're expected to continue to do the same things that got them tenure in the first place, often that's not measured in a way that's consistent, and there's a lack of benchmarks. And the other a notion that was identified was that for MD faculty, there's also a greater potential for changes in career directions. Many MDs will start their career more along a research line, and that may evolve more into administration or in a clinical direction as time goes on. So there's an important difference here between the MD and the PhD faculty. So on the basis of those points, the subgroup came up with the following recommendations. The tenure should be dissociated from the guarantee of permanent economic support, and five-year rolling contracts should be instituted for all new tenured positions. So the notion of a five-year rolling contract is that on an annual basis you're reviewed. If you do all the things that you were hired to do, and this has to be spelled out carefully in your letter of offer, then your contract is extended by that year. So in a sense, you have a five-year cushion, or a five-year point in time. If indeed you stop doing the things that you are. Recognition by peers would continue to, I think in many people's minds, would continue to be important. But the question is, as we try and implement a program along these lines, we need to bring the lower campus and the university online in terms of implementing these kinds of changes. And it, as those of you who are involved with MAUT or involved with lower campus, I think could well recognize, as we play with how we define tenure, there may be issues related to how the university responds to the recommendations that we made. So I think this is one of the, that if we go with this kind of approach, this is one of the issues that, that we're going to have to try and reconcile. The other thing that I think that's worth mentioning as we're talking about reconsidering tenure for MD faculty is this new remuneration recherche program, which many of you are familiar with, which is the notion that clinical researchers should be compensated for the time they spend in research to a level that's commensurate with what their clinical counterparts are doing, so that there's another opportunity to bring additional monies into the system and thereby be sure that MD faculty are being compensated adequately for the time that they spend in research. The subgroup on remuneration and tenure for PhD faculty had a very different take on it. Some of the background issues are the same, limited number of tenure positions, but really they felt quite strongly that tenure must remain the cornerstone of recruitment for PhD scientists. That being said, recognizing the fact that there weren't adequate number of tenure track positions available and that there's a need to be able to respond to science as it develops in a quick fashion, this group felt that it was important to be able to develop a non-tenure track academic career pathway, which had many of the same sorts of privileges and responsibilities as the tenure track. Again, a rolling contract, that type of approach could be applied. There would be the potential to track jump so that you can come in on non-tenure track, and if a tenure track position becomes available, you're not precluded for applying for that position. Again, issues related to trying to implement these recommendations, and I think that the main issue is outlined in the next line. The subgroup for promotion on promotion criteria and recognition for GFTH faculty. So, again, to just give you a little bit of background, if 16% are GFTU faculty of the MD faculty, that means that 84% are GFTH faculty. So this is a sizable component of our faculty who, as many of you know, do the lion's share of teaching in these rooms, in the hospitals, students, residents, etc. Indeed, it represents about 60% of our full-time faculty, and I think as of last Wednesday, I can take away the quotation marks. There's different career streams within GFTH faculty. Again, some are carrying out careers that are indistinguishable from our tenure-track faculty. Some are master clinicians, teachers, etc., etc. On the other hand, despite the fact that there's different career streams, we apply the same criteria for promotion as we do to tenure-track faculty. And that's a situation, you know, that obviously is problematic if we want to recognize people and promote people for what it is they do and for what it is they're hired to do. Finally, many of the GH-FTH faculty who are around the committee, and this is something that's come up, I think, in many conversations, and as well at the GFTH task force that reported to the committee that reported to Senate, there's a disconnect amongst GFTH faculty with the Faculty of Medicine. There's a sense that there's a lack of recognition, that they're not appreciated for what they bring to the table, and this is a situation that needs to be addressed. So in terms of the specific recommendation, number one, if people are working full-time, they should be recognized as full-time by the university. So as the dean mentioned before, I'm happy to report that, in fact, as of a week ago, that's corrected. There was also the notion that we should develop a clinical stream, so assistant associate full professors, and that for those professors, the appropriate promotion criteria that reflected, again, what it is they do would be applied. Things like employee benefits, access to a pension plan, these are benefits and situations that should be extended to a GFTH faculty. Until, I guess, a week ago, things like teaching awards, sabbaticals, these things weren't available to GFTH faculty. So all of these things needed to be corrected. So in terms of the promotion criteria, just to expand a little bit, as you know or may know, there's three major categories of promotion criteria that are considered. One is teaching. One is other contributions to the university and scholarly community, and one is research and other scholarly activity. So the suggestion of the committee was that by just tweaking this sum, the devil's in the details, we could actually expand and improve the promotion criteria so that it encompassed what it is people do within this clinical track. So research and or other scholarly activity, including professional or clinical innovation, and clinical excellence. So we felt that would make a great strides. Promotion to full professor at the university would still require international reputation because, as you know, to receive promotion to full professor, one needs to go through the secretariat. Clinical excellence is a tricky thing to define. I think we all know it when we see it. Scott Wright, again, who came and spoke to us, has comprised a body of work where he's looked at this, managed to develop some quantifiable metrics, which is always, one of the challenges when we're talking about clinical excellence. But these are some of the different qualities that he's identified and attached metrics to. So I think this is something that we need to pursue and think about in future. As the dean mentioned, last week, May 19th, which actually was a year to the date that we submitted our GFTH task force report to the provost, the non-tenure track academic staff recommendations were presented to Senate, and this proposal was approved. It incorporated the specific recommendations of the GFTH task force, which actually dovetail very nicely with the GFTH subgroup of our life cycle, and I think speak to how robust those proposals were and are. People are full-time because they're working full-time. There's a clinical track that's defined, as well a research track, and this goes back to the proposal by the PhD group that there should be a non-tenure track research track identified and developed. For the promotions to full professor, they identified, again, three major areas: teaching, other contributions, and now within that second category, they define one, you have to have one of the following three: either contributions in research, The second is professional and or clinical innovation that has an influence on the practice of the profession and that is published, publicized, or otherwise recognized in a way that makes possible its evaluation by external peers. So I think this is a great advance and enables us to recognize the clinical contributions and the clinical innovations that our clinical staff are making. Sustained creative activity, if you're a musician, that resonates, no pun intended for you. This is for full professor. With the non-tenure track recommendations, it's recognized that for other promotions, for example, for assistant to associate professor for non-tenure track or now what's called contract academic staff, it's up to the individual faculties to define which are the criteria they want to apply. But certainly this is the sort of thing we can work with, and indeed, patterns very closely to what the strategic plan group came up with as well. Just to finish, for the subgroup on work-life balance, I think that this is again one of those issues that we're all in violent agreement on, that we need to find ways to encourage women especially to have successful careers with the issues related to having families and being able to balance all of these various issues. I mean, there's other other situations as well where people need to strike the balance between their responsibilities at work and their life responsibilities. And one of the specific recommendations that the subgroup make was that the university should formalize the possibility of a reduced workload status for researchers and clinicians, because this is something that has not yet been adequately addressed. We need additional resources. I think it's up to the faculty to try and the university to try and define those resources so we can make these things happen. There was also a subgroup on mentoring. There, in fact, was a mentoring policy, which is excellent, already in place at the faculty, but it's not instituted in any kind of consistent way. It's variable amongst different departments. So the feeling was that in order for a successful approach to mentoring to be instituted, we needed to establish a formal program that would be overseen by the dean's office, in collaboration, obviously, with the chairs, Tsar or Tsarina, I suppose. And I also identified, and as Joyce mentioned, one of the issues we need to deal with vis-a-vis accreditation was that all faculty, whether PhD, MD tenure track, or MD non-tenure track, research track, we need to give regular feedback to our faculty. These are the various contributors, the various committee members for the Faculty Lifecycle Design Group, and as Joyce mentioned, in her experience, everyone worked very hard and long hours to try and get their minds around the various issues, to review the literature that was out there, the experience at other medical schools, and I would like to thank all these people for having contributed in such an important fashion. So I'll take some questions.
I would assume that you're planning that the level of excellence of the two streams would be, candidates of the two streams would be equivalent. Okay. So what would be the carrot and the option for the track?
Well, I mean, hopefully, you know, working conditions, opportunity to become a member of the faculty, but I think you're raising an interesting point. Is, you know, if you can't offer financial security, what do you offer instead? You know, one of the suggestions that came out was, you know, do you have to offer a somewhat higher salary in order to recompense for the fact that you know, it's not a salary necessarily through to the end of your career. I mean, I think that's one you know, possibility, and you know, hence the dollar signs at the bottom. So I think that's something that we have to try and address. But again, you know, we need to have a mechanism to bring additional people into the system and not be constrained by the number of tenure track slots that are available from the provost. and deal with the situation at hand. But I think you raise a very very important point.
There's also, if I may, promotion. One of the problems with the current system and the existence of only a single pathway to promotion to full professor was the call for what we might call a full-time traditional career. It's inappropriate for the multiplicity of the pathways that we have represented in Mara Scrub. And so creating criteria for promotion through all the ranks that are appropriate to the careers of the people who are actually in the non-tenure track ranks, and then using a system which is based on merit to promote those faculty is important and different than where we are now, because many of those never make it to associate or full professor.
David, is that wasn't quite clear from the presentation. Is it the intention that no MDs will be put on tenure track anymore, including people who are Cheshire or CA, not from the CA, but say Cheshire rate is 75%?
I think that's the plan. I mean, that's the proposal. Is that if you're an MD,
without a specialty, MD is your primary degree, MD PhD.
If you're an MD and part of the clinical faculty, by clinical faculty, I mean you're defining. Yes. I mean you're defining it. I'm defining as an MD is someone who practices medicine.
Holds a license and sees patients.
Yes. Holds a license and sees patients. If they're an MD PhD who primarily does research at in this building, for example, then I think it's not the same thing as an MD who's in one of the hospitals carrying out the research in that domain, seeing patients. So that's the group that we're defining.
And the other question I have, which is really not a big issue, has this been discussed with the Council of Physicians and Surgeons teaching hospitals? And then
Not as yet. I mean,
the promotion issues there, even though they're much more arbitrary, like to assistant physician, full position, are these going to be then harmonized?
I'm not sure that they use those. David, use those systems
anymore. No, it's been abolished because the government has imposed active associate. And you can, and most councils have honorary or consultant conseil.
So I think that question is moot. Can people hear the questions that are being asked, or no? Do we have any of the microphones that are working?
This one works.
All right. So then I'll be sure to repeat the questions. I'm not sure who is next. Jim, were you? Oh no, Vasily. Jim. Vasily's hand was up before. Well, not just so he's saying, I assume the reason for this change is financial. Not just financial, perhaps it's financial for the provo, but I think that, our issue in the faculty is that we have a limited number of tenure track positions available, which means financial, but, we're not controlling the pot, as it were.
Have you done a financial analysis, what that means between now and 5 years, 10 years from now? With the change, what means without the change? Because many things were raised, issue like people that maybe they are not good enough anymore, but the faculty handbook has guidelines that you can take care of that. So changing the entire system, only in one school, only faculty of medicine, and not throughout the university, I find personally problematic. Other, physicians, they're in the hospitals, they have, people say, two jobs, they teach, they do research. But faculty at the law school, they have law offices, and also they are teaching their tenure faculty. So cannot be, I think it's wrong to have one approach only for one faculty. Tenure is given by the university. So the university has to be, this has to be approached across the entire system, not only to the faculty. And concerning the faculty, I think it would be very important to see a financial analysis the next 5-10 years. What will be the cost of the change? And I think if you talk to other schools that they did that, the change, the financial change was zero, because they ended up to recruit people, they ended up creating endowment after endowment. Mm-hmm. Instead to pay the money this way, they were paying different ways, or guarantee contracts for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years to retain people. So you may end up with something that everybody thinks is fine, but at the end, as a financial statement, we will see the same problems.
So we haven't yet done a financial analysis. My first response to your question was that it's not so much about the money as about the tenure positions available. And I'll stick with that to some extent, because I think that as part of the proposal and going to a system of rolling contracts, tied into that or built into that is the capacity to have an annual review to be sure that people are living up to what it is that they were hired to do. And that permits us the possibility that if people aren't continuing to produce in terms of research papers, research grants, whatever the specifics are, that there's the possibility then to remove their or diminish their financial support. So at least we have a mechanism of feedback, and that's something that's new that in the current system we don't effectively have. Well, it's very difficult. It's very, very difficult. Harvey. Sorry, Jim went next. Harvey?
Yes. The issue of hospital-based research troubles me in some of the wording that you're using. For example, we have a number of clinician scientist researchers funded by FRSQ with 75% research careers. Is the implication of this system that's being proposed that those are non-tenure track, is implicit there will be no university dollars going to them? Is that
no, the bottom line? I think this idea of a role, what we need to do, of course, is develop our own ideas, take them to the university. The university is putting in a certain budget to support our professors. We have to maintain control of that budget and then use that to supply the monies that will then supply the rolling contracts. So it's a question of capturing those monies that are now being put into tenure track. This is something that's going to have to be put in place over a long period of time, obviously. But to recapture those monies, either because of retirements that occur, for example, that's one pool of monies to recapture. There's monies that may become available through endowments, et cetera, and those will form the monies that then enable us to introduce this system and have the rolling contract. So the rolling contract has to be paid to some extent or to some contribution by university monies in partnership with the research institutes as we're doing currently. So that would be the premise. Jim, sorry.
I think that we'll stop at this point and move on to a discussion of the research design group's findings, and then if you're interested in staying at the end of that, we'll come back to this issue.
Thank you, Mark.
So, good afternoon. This one? Okay. Thank you. I'll just shoot. Yeah, maybe. Is that okay? I don't want to come over too loud. So the research design group had a lot of fun putting this together. Research, as you will realize, is a much different kettle of fish than the other two sorts of groups, and that research is an absolutely enormous thing. But in fact, if you look at what we do at the Faculty of Medicine and in universities in general, is that we're in the business of producing, of manufacturing and producing knowledge, and it can walk out of here or it can go out of here into major journals. And one thing that really came over in our discussions is that we have to ensure the impact of that knowledge, the excellence of the research that leads to that knowledge, and then the impact of that knowledge. So what I'm going to do is just take you briefly through what we did, the planning process,
We have 27 committee members from basic and clinical sciences, campuses, institutes. We had three town halls. We had one of them was a call-in. We had 45 white papers submitted, which were all available to you on the site. My co-chairs were Mariana Newkirk and Remy Quillion. And we had a whole set of subcommittees that looked at specific issues. So this was really a very large task that we took on. I guess now we realize how large it was. But let me say this. At a university, we're not a corporation. We're not IBM. We're not GM. We're not GSK or whatever. Really, research is done in a bunch of specific groups and specific colleagues and individuals. And really, really our task, I think, if you think about it at one level or even a deeper level, is how can we facilitate that research? How can we make it more excellent? How can we make have more impact, our research have more impact? And we really kind of thought around those two sorts of concepts during the making of this plan. So, as I said, we have an enormous and very impressive research capability here. Our assets, of course, are the investigators and the students and their colleagues. And we have many sites, some better than others in terms of their infrastructure. And maybe part of our problems is the diversity in the off-site. We can't alter geography in terms of interaction. That will come up in a moment. Three schools and many PIs are in different faculties and in different schools. So we try to come up with a goal that kind of spoke back a little to the idea that Osler came up with that first quote. And it was actually extraordinarily difficult to do that, so we kind of left it till the last. But we said, well, maybe where we're going is towards personalized medicine. So here it is. I'll flash through it very fast. And it spoke to those criteria that I, those values, sorry, that I gave you earlier. And we want to be internationally recognized by a medical school. I think we already are. I mean, we stand on the shoulders of giants, and we want to give something back better to the next generation at McGill. We want to be a leader in patient-oriented research, and we want to be a pioneer in some new and emerging research areas. And that translational aspect of what we do in all its aspects, not just commercializations of things, but in terms of adopting new practices and things like this, I think that's some area where I think we will be able to make an enormous impact. And we encourage innovation in all our facets of health research. We are excellent. There's all these awards and things that we have. One thing that we noticed that maybe McGill is not doing so well is in leading national and international networks. I'm sure you're all going to say, well, I do one or whatever. But in general, I think McGill is not doing quite so well there. Well, what do we want to do? We want to promote and the talk now is structured. I'll go through a few slides which give you some of the information that was behind the recommendations, and then I'll rapidly go through the recommendations. So for research excellence, we want to promote and facilitate collaboration across departments. That really already occurs, but how can we do it better? How can we encourage more multidisciplinary research? That will come in a moment. And we have some prototypes, the Cancer Network partnership between the MUHC, Research Institute, the Jewish, and the faculty. The Integrated Neuroscience Program are some examples of what we're doing. Really, they should be examples that we just don't adopt blindly. We should look at the strengths and maybe the weaknesses of those programs and take the best out of those and establish how they should be done. There was one a clinical research center to support clinician scientists and integrated knowledge translation. This was very well presented, and the reasons for that I'll come to in a moment. This was actually a really kind of innovative suggestion that spoke to a lot of people on the committee, and I'd be interested in your reaction. Multidisciplinary research, well, this is the current mantra, but I think it really has legs to it, in that multidisciplinary research, if you want to see what you do translated to make the better lives for your patients, for your fellow citizens, you're not going to be able to do it all yourself. You have to find a way of networking and interacting with those people that are in engineering or in other faculties or in other universities. So I think this is really going to be an area in where we can really work out best practices, which will be many, and then share those best practices with our colleagues with the view of improving the efficiency of the process. So research teams were doing these things right now. It's interesting that the CHR that was actually preaching multidisciplinarity actually just abolished its team research, its CHR team research program. But that being said, I still think it's a good idea. So we have some support to broaden the support. Sorry, the recommendations are here. You can read them. I'll move on to the next. Another is research centers and networks. There's a confusing nomenclature. Not quite as confusing as GFT, H, and U, was it? Yeah. But centers vary from large institutes to small virtual groups. These are semantic problems. Maybe we should have baby centers, middle-aged centers, and old centers or something. But maybe we can come up with a set of, as the FRSQ does, with equip, group, SART. Maybe we can sort of try and fit things into that, but I don't think we should try too hard. Centers and networks should certainly be accountable to the faculty, and the criteria of the creation of new ones, the evaluation, the impact, and dedicated funding are really concerns that I think the faculty should buy into. Obviously, most centers are bringing a lot more money than they get from the VP research. Who's not here? Sorry, but certainly they are speaking to our mission of excellence in translation, and I think we should encourage them. Core facilities. That's a little bit different. In core facilities, we have a clear vision of what a core facility is. It's something that enhances your research, that brings in a high level expertise, the imaging center that's run in the Bellini building, for example, is one example, and there are many others. Many cores lack scientific oversight. I'm not quite sure about that because usually they're grant-funded. Cost recovery is always a challenge. CHR walked away from its equipment maintenance programs. And then the faculty should create mechanisms for establishing and reviewing core facilities based on needs and on excellence, I would say, and assisting core facilities in the development of its financial and administrative foundations and, in some way, its science. The clinical research core facility that I spoke about earlier is really one that would help clinicians with their granting and getting granting process, a data management platform for long-term monitoring for longitudinal studies, creation of a comprehensive cohort of patients, for example, a little bit like Catagen is doing right now for genetics, and having a larger element of biostatistical and organizational support. So this would be part of an integrated KT Center, Knowledge Translation Center, that would probably give a good bridge between clinical and basic sciences. Here are the recommendations. Training is another one. Our ratio of PI to PhD student is 1.2. So this is much lower by a factor of 8 than, for example, the Faculty of Religious Studies. I think we can do a lot better here. And we're not really sure what the real reason for this is. But obviously, this is an area where we could certainly expand. Training, well, we want to turn out excellent people at all levels. They're going to come from McGill. We want them out there with our brand on them. Partnerships and innovation. I was very surprised to find that, in fact, McGill does very well. The Faculty of Medicine produces 62% of patent applications. It ranks third in licensing after UBC and U of T in Canada, which is not bad. Both these organizations have very large knowledge transfer and commercialization outfits. And we're in a great position to nurture proactive approaches to partnerships to pharmaceutical companies. They're definitely changing their way of working. They need more innovation from universities. They are resource rich and ideas poor right now, and I think that's a real area that we can exploit. And the recommendation there is to establish an enterprise innovation center. I'm not quite sure how we're going to do this, but certainly there are some excellent people on the campus and off the campus who can help us, I think, establish this sort of enterprise. The organization we have into departments and schools, 22 departments that are spread out across the campus, schools, and the faculty itself has no school of medicine where undergraduate medical education occurs. So the recommendation there is to create a faculty of health or life sciences with the creation of a school of medicine, a school of life and social science, a school of basic science. And that may be a way of addressing one of the other problems that we identify is the death of, or the absence, the drying up of clinician scientists. We are seeing less and less of these rare birds flying past our windows. And I think that maybe part of that is the way in which undergraduate education occurs on the campus. So that, we thought, was perhaps that maybe we should have, the faculty should have more influence on undergraduate biomedical education. And, there's a slide missing. Where's Tash? in fact, the number of undergraduate science students enrolled at McGill, 62% of those are actually in the programs of anatomy and cell biology, biochemistry, physiology, and now pharmacology. I'm missing somebody here. Microbiology. I'm talking about undergraduates right now. And so it's an enormous number, but we have no control over their admission, and we don't have a lot of control over their early training. And this probably should be an area that we should look at very carefully. For a lot of disparate reasons, and I think it would enable us to improve the quality of our product, even going up into undergraduate medical education and beyond. I think we need to kind of look at those programs, see how they're being trained, see how research is being presented to them, see how research is really their exposure to research, and then develop rational programs around that. These are the dedicated people that the research design group. It was really a lot of fun doing this. It was, as I said, we were naive enough not to think that it was much of a challenge at the beginning. It became more and more of a challenge. And I will single out every one of these colleagues for really taking a lot of time out of their lives to develop this. And then I'll thank Ildi, who has, if you're really interested, the detailed slides, including the missing ones, I think, that you may want to look at. Thank you very much for your attention.
Questions for Dr. Thomas and colleagues?
Oh, hi, Heather.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. just want to discuss your ratio of 1.2 graduate students, and I just wonder what the denominator is, because
denominator.
We're a little different from other faculties at the university in that there is a segment of our population that doesn't supervise graduate students. Now, one could argue whether one should or shouldn't, but I think that that's important in our faculty to make distinctions amongst those who are serving, you know, largely undergraduate medical education, and those who, you know, that we distinguish between who has the qualifications to supervise graduate students, and that we have accountability in that area. Because I suspect it's that ratio is arising because we're counting people who just don't do it, and maybe shouldn't, and don't want to, and have other functions within the university.
Yeah, exactly, a really good point. We did take all of the faculty, the registered professors in the Faculty of Medicine, right? So that includes people in the hospitals, but don't forget, they are producing, but they produce actually MDs and not PhDs or masters. Yeah. Yeah, but
we have many different segments of our faculty that are experts on very different
types of education. But you know better than any of us that even if we take those out, the ratio is still a lot lower than in other faculties across McGill, right? So divided by my half, let's say half the people that we have, so we're now at 2.4. That's still low in comparison with Faculty of Science. So I think the average is 4.2, so it's something like that. You know better than me, but
Thank you very much for the nice presentation. Can you tell us how many clinician scientists we have in the Faculty of Medicine? Have they been herded or clustered and incentivized and encouraged to mentor? Because I think that's part of the way that we're going to get to the stated goal.
Good point. The culture varies across because, quite frankly, if people have the time or it will vary across departments and across schools, and that's a very good point. There is not one-size-fits-all thing here. Definitely, we rejoice in our diversity, and some units and departments are definitely not going to produce PhDs.
David, just to, you know, the numbers issue. Just the numbers issue. Voice. So we have about 190 GFTUs. We have about, you know, maybe 20 GFTHs who have salary awards from FRSQ and CIHR. So, I mean, that gives you, but of course that's early in the career. It doesn't speak to people who are non-tenure track but don't have salary awards because they're too senior. But it gives you some sort of notion of what the number might be, 250.
So that's potential. And if you think that they identify one another and are an identifiable group that might be encouraged to go forth and multiply?
To experience the joys of graduate supervision.
I mean, sprinkle on a little bit of information recherche, and they might.
Clinical research center. The creation, eventually, of a clinical research center could be one way. Because there, of course, mentoring and training would be very important.
Yeah. Banana.
Thank you. Whether we've considered the creation of a School of Public Health, because in fact, I think a lot of the problems that we heard in Joyce's presentation relate to public health issues. We have many other components of that, such a school. We've chosen not to do that. Many other universities have. University of Montreal has just started one. So that was one general question.
So that did come up. It was proposed in at least two papers of our white papers that actually came and presented. Jordi Hyman, we need leadership, and we need to we have very strong public health components, and we need somebody to lead it. Rebecca? and to come up with a rational plan. But I think those are the sorts of things we should be looking for. Maybe not the Harvard School of Public Health or the University of Montreal, but the McGill one could link into the department to the School of the Environment, for example. I think there are lots of opportunities here. And I think what we want is people just to take this and take these initiatives, and we'll try and help. We'll try and help you.
And the second aspect relates to the numbers that were brought up and discussed by several people. I think you've got to look at perhaps who is supervising at least one graduate student as your denominator, and try to understand why we have such a large group of people who are not supervising anybody. Those who supervise at least one, as a rule, will supervise many more than one.
Yeah, I know people who supervise 20, several. I agree, and quite often it's funding, but I think we need to encourage a culture of, in certain parts, we need to encourage people to really experience the graduate education. I see a colleague there who really gets a lot of fun out of it. It's really part of the joy of what we do. It's not what the papers, 10 years' time, papers we publish will be forgotten, but the people we train, they'll be there and they'll remember us.
Per person. So how many faculty have zero graduate students? How many have one, two, three? Then that gives us a better idea of what we're looking at. And
yeah, we have the numbers. We don't have them in the presentation. We didn't want to. The answer to the questions is not, well, this particular area of McGill doesn't have. It's more complex than that, but we do have the data. Mariana Newkirk has the data, and I think Ildi also has the raw data.
Okay. And in many cases, over a number of meetings, that's all we ever get.
Yeah, I think it's good to encourage inquiry and discussion.
Sorry,
I think you agree there.
It isn't meant to point fingers, but it's to help us understand the problem and to understand what's going on.
We looked at really what might be going on, but as I said, we could not sort of really come up with the reason. You know, there were individuals in departments, for example, that would have lots of graduate students, and that individual would be quite well funded, and he or she would have one or two. It was not a very easily solvable problem within the constraints that we had. I think we should have some sort of deeper look at that, and we're looking for people to lead that sort of inquiry.
Because it's also, I'd like to make the thing that it's not the supervisor is just marked as one, but a number of faculty contribute to the training and the supervision of graduate students that don't get counted in your numbers. But I just think it's a way of looking at it. But clearly, there has to be, just strictly in terms of numbers, we could be provided with more information. Similar with to another example is, for example, if there are where the students are complaining about their being abused or whatever, give us a distribution of just in terms of classification, is it the clinicians, is it the PhDs, is it in the basic teaching? We need to have some idea of where these problems are. And it's like we don't get disclosure of information.
Sometimes, you know, the information is a little bit, what we'd like to do, I think, is have focus groups to look at that. And we see, maybe you could volunteer to lead one. Certainly, these are issues. Sometimes the information, particularly in the abuse, you know, if you were to look at that that increase in abuse, I mean, my first thought is, well, we had a new dean and it went up, right? So, but I'm sure it's not coming from the dean. But to find the real source of this is sometimes the information is a little bit sticky. It's not something you want to put up on a slide in public. That's not true of what I was involved in, which was the number of graduate students per faculty, that's something that gets sort of sent back to us from Lowell campus. Do better, guys, you know. And I agree, the answer is not simple. Yeah. Patty, you had something.
Was there any discussion surrounding how many graduates, why you're fixated on numbers?
I'm not fixated on numbers at all.
Well, you provide us with 1.2 or 1.4, so you put it up there. So I was wondering how, and we're not doing better, we should do better, we should have more graduate students. So what was this discussion surrounding how many PhDs, where do they go, how do we follow them?
So the big picture, I agree. So here's a problem that we identify that I think is something is how many graduate students should we, are we cloning ourselves, are we making the next generation, are we creating people that go into other professions, or are we just creating people that are going to be university professors? Not that there's anything wrong with that. And I think that's a really great question. Those of us who've been involved in evaluating the CREATE programs look and question sometimes of producing lots of students in areas where there's really not a demand.
So, important discussion, but I think I would like some of you at least to look at all the recommendations that we have made, because some of them are also could be quite important. If you change the way the Faculty of Medicine is organized, or you create new center, get rid of some department, that could have a huge impact. So I think hopefully we'll get feedback on you on some of those. The number of grad students is important. The principal of the university, she's very much focused on that aspect, and there is probably many, many reasons for it. One thing that was not mentioned is postdoc. We have a lot of postdoc also, and some of the schools do not have as many postdocs, so we have to look at the whole thing. But please look at the recommendation to be available to all of you. There are probably copies in the back that you could take.
Thank you. David, we're losing our audience. It's understandable. Thank you all for this discussion. Let me tell you what's going to happen. By June 15th, the external advisory group of scientists and educators in North America will complete their work, have evaluated the design group's proposals, and we will give the design groups an opportunity to modify their thinking based on what the external review has said. We will then post all of the reports and all of the data, and there's video and many elements that were and could not be discussed in a summary today that will be posted on a website to which you all have access, and engage everyone in as broad a conversation as possible that will be departmentally and thematically based. And then we plan to have a very large retreat in the fall in which we involve as many people as possible, nominated by their chairs, in which we will come to terms with the final reports as offered after the modifications that I've described. We have a reception waiting for us. I would like you to join me in thanking our 100 colleagues and their chairs for this extraordinary amount of work. Thank you very much.